Now broadcasting in English.
Hello and welcome to this weekend edition of Radio Prague, the international service of Czech radio. My name's Christian Falvey. Many thanks for tuning in. Starting off an excellent program for today, David Vaughan introduces us to Charles Otto Heller, an accidental soldier in World War II. After that, in Science Journal, we go underneath central Prague. And later on in our program, another trip through the Czech radio archives. All that ahead, so please stay tuned. In the last days of World War II, 9-year-old Otto Heller picked up a revolver and fired it at a German soldier. He did not wait to see if the man was still alive. For decades afterwards, he talked to no one about the experience, and only recently has Otto Heller, or Charles Otto Heller as he is now called, felt able to return to his memories of the war, collecting them in his book, Out of Prague. In this week's Czech Books, he talks to David Vaughan.
Now in his mid-70s, Charles Otto Heller has had a highly successful career in the United States, where he and his parents fled from communist Czechoslovakia in 1948. He was 12 at the time, and his parents were determined to put their past behind them, having lost nearly all their relatives in the Holocaust. With his new name, Charles went on to become an American success story, an athlete, academic, engineer, entrepreneur, father and grandfather. He would never speak of his childhood experiences as a half-Jewish boy hiding from the Nazis in a village near Prague. It was only with the fall of communism in 1989 that everything changed, culminating in the publication of Out of Prague, his memories of the time. This week saw the launch of the Czech translation, Dlouhá cesta domů, and I asked Charles Otto Heller to tell me more about how the book came about.
Americans began in 1989 to get interested in this small country in Central Europe. And then they put two things together that, you know, that I really did come from there and started asking me questions. And as they started to ask questions, I actually started remembering some of the things. And one after another person, people would say, oh, you got to write a book. Of course, you know, having friends and neighbors tell you you need to write a book, that doesn't mean that there really is a book there. But I began writing just short stories and vignettes that had taken place, and it was amazing how memories began to come back to me in the middle of the night and remembering things that happened to me when I was 4 years old and 5 years old. I didn't think it was possible to remember.
Did you have some sort of Proustian moment where it suddenly all came flooding back?
I did. The first time I came back, it was in 1990. And I came actually to a conference here. And my first night, I couldn't sleep, so I just put my clothes on and I walked up to the castle. And I was there completely alone at the cathedral. And suddenly it just hit me how much this country had been through and how few years the people here had been free. And I absolutely broke down and I got on my knees and started to cry, just kneeling there all alone in the middle of the night. It was about midnight, and it suddenly hit me that I'm still Czech.
And was that feeling also tied in with your own really very traumatic experiences as a child in the occupied protectorate of Bohemia and Moravia, as the country was called then?
Yes, it did. And that's when those thoughts began coming back, because again, I had driven all of those things out of my mind, and they began, all those stories and some of the hardships began to come back to me at that point, and I started writing them down as I started to remember them.
So tell me a little bit of the story.
I was born in 1936, 3 years before the occupation. My father was Jewish. My mother was Catholic. Actually, my mother's father was Jewish and her mother was Catholic. So I actually had three Jewish grandparents, but I didn't know that. My great-grandfather started a clothing factory and was very successful, and we were quite wealthy. And my family, I lived with my parents and my great-grandfather, my grandfather, and his brother. We celebrated Christmas, we celebrated Easter. It was just as if we were a Catholic family, and that's what I thought we all were.
And you were only three when the occupation of Bohemia and Moravia began. After that, you must have had no choice but to be aware of being of Jewish origin, because the laws made it so, didn't they?
Actually, no, I was not aware, because my father escaped in 1940 and to join the British Army, eventually, after he was arrested in Belgrade, and eventually they were forming the Czechoslovak division of the British Army in Palestine, and he joined there, and then he fought with Montgomery in North Africa and so forth. And then my grandfather and his brother also escaped. It turned out that they were killed in Yugoslavia by the Germans. So just my mother and my great-grandfather stayed behind. And eventually the Germans came and they took the factory and our home. And we moved in with some farmer friends in the village of Kojetice. Then things began to happen. I wondered, why did we have to move out? Why wasn't I allowed to go to school when my friends started to go to school? And the answer was always the same from my mother: because your father is fighting against the Germans. So I had no idea that it had anything to do with my Jewish heritage or any religious background. To me, it was always because your father is fighting against the Germans.
How did you and your mother survive?
My mother worked on the farm where we were living. She worked every day. My mother was a fine lady, brought up to be a lady. She went to the English school in Prague and, never worked. Had a cook, and I had nannies when I was a little boy, and suddenly my mother was a field hand working 7 days a week, and my great-grandfather then was taken away to a concentration camp, which was a very traumatic experience for me because he became my best friend. I had no one else, and he was 82 years old. Eventually, the Germans took the farm away from the farmers with whom we were staying, and they moved into a larger farm where other farmers were gathered and essentially living in a dormitory. It was a place we all the villagers called the castle, called Zamek. And that's where we lived. And then my mother was taken away toward the end of the war, 1944, to a slave labor camp for Christian wives of Jewish men. The Germans wanted to take me along, I found out later. But my mother hid me at that point with the farmers. So I was hidden in the castle. That's where I was when the war ended.
And in connection with the end of the war, I'd love it if you could read a short extract from your book, Out of Prague. And maybe if you could introduce this extract first, because it is the most extraordinary episode.
As I was being hidden in this place called the castle, the war was coming to an end, and we heard rumors that the war was coming to an end, but we all found it hard to believe. So I will read this portion from my book where the traumatic event which took place for me as the war was ending. Finally, I swallowed hard and carefully drew the Walter from my belt, getting on my feet, cocking the pistol, and assuming a two-handed pose I had seen in American cowboy movies before the war. I aimed at the blonde-haired man's chest. I squeezed the trigger. Bam! The noise was shattering. The pistol recoiled and flew out of my hand, and I was propelled into the bushes. "You got him," screamed Pepik. I crawled out of the bush, and sure enough, the man was lying on the ground. Leaving the gun behind, I took off running as fast as I could toward the farmhand's dormitory, with my companions running in different directions. Amazingly, no one followed us. After an initial crush of fear, I experienced an adrenaline rush unlike any I had ever felt before. "I killed a German," I screamed silently. "I killed a German." I did not know if I had really killed him, but I hoped that I had. In that splendid moment, I felt as if I had single-handedly won the war. For most of my young life, I had been running and hiding from the Germans. Now, finally, I had struck back. I had taken revenge for everything they had done to me, for taking my family from me, for stealing our home and our possessions, for forcing me to hide like an animal, for desecrating my beloved Czechoslovakia. I was 9 years old, and I vowed to keep my triumph a secret. It would be many years later, after finally revealing the secret to my family and a few friends, that I would receive startling information which would make me wonder, whom did I shoot that day in May 1945?
So what was the startling information?
I spoke to the chronicler of our village of Kojetice, whose name is Yaroslav Kuchera, who's been very carefully writing the history of the village up to today. I actually sent him the story and I asked him if he knew who the person was that I shot. And he informed me that it could not have been a German soldier, because by that time the German soldiers were gone, but that there were Czech collaborators who were living in those places where the boys and I were, in the bushes. And he is quite certain that the man I shot was a Czech Nazi collaborator who, with his wife, was escaping to Germany. And he also said that I could not have killed him, because it's a small village, and if somebody is shot and killed in a village like that, everyone knows about it. And they had heard that somebody had been shot and hurt, but not that he was killed. So all those years I lived with the thought that I had killed a German soldier, but I had wounded a Czech.
I cannot imagine how you feel. I mean, I can't imagine what it feels like, the very fact of, as a small child, being in that position of shooting somebody. Yeah. How does it feel?
All those years that I thought I had actually killed the German soldier, I felt very good about it. However, I was afraid to talk to anyone about it. I didn't tell my parents, because I thought maybe I had committed a criminal act. After all, people are killed in war, but not by little civilian boys. So I kept it to myself, and I never told my father. So my father died without ever knowing. I did tell my mother eventually, 2 years before she died.
It must have been a bit of a shock, I should imagine.
It was a shock to my mother. My mother had a look of absolute shock on her face. And then she looked at me and she said, "You did well." And patted me on the shoulder and kissed me.
But the soldier you thought you'd shot was also some mother's son.
That's true. But somehow I never thought about it that way. You know, to me, I had such a hatred for Germans as well as the Czechs who collaborated with them that I didn't think of them really as human beings.
And what about now that you know what probably really happened?
I have mixed feelings. On the one hand, I wish that I had killed a German soldier. On the other hand, I guess I've begun some process of forgiveness, and I'm glad that I didn't kill anyone, that maybe I just wounded him, and probably he's okay if he's still alive today.
Of course, you don't even know that, do you? I mean, it could be. He could have even not have been a collaborator.
I've thought about that since Mr. Kuchera told me what he thinks that the true story was. Mm-hmm. I've thought about that possibility, but I think that's quite unlikely because, first of all, normal Czechs who were not collaborators didn't have access to vehicles, and this man was packing his... Mm-hmm. And this was the first week in May, and he was packing furniture, and obviously he was leaving town, and people weren't leaving at that time unless they had something to do with the Germans. I did this all my own free will, so I was totally responsible for what I did. And I was proud of it, you know, in my own silent way, I was proud of myself. Especially when my father came home, even though I never told my father. My father was, to me, was a hero when he arrived in that British uniform.
What do you think he would have said?
I don't think he would have been proud of me.
Do you feel that writing this book has been a catharsis, in a sense?
In a way, it has been a catharsis, but at the same time, it was very painful. Some of the memories were extremely painful. There were ones that I had suppressed for a very long time. But many things happened from the process of writing the book, and probably the main thing that happened to me was that I gained even more respect for my parents than I ever had because of what they went through. And even after all they went through in World War II, then 2.5 years later escaping from the communists and leaving this country with absolutely nothing and starting from nothing in America and living normal lives. And it's just something I can't even imagine at this point, what they accomplished and what they did for me.
Charles Otaheller, thank you very much indeed for talking to us at Radio Prague. And your book is published in English as Out of Prague and in Czech as Dlouhá cesta domů. And Best of luck with it. Thank you.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
David Vaughan there talking to Charles Otta Heller, and that edition of Czech Books was first broadcast in April of 2011. This is Radio Prague. Now, in this month's edition of Science Journal, there's a hole in the middle of Prague, and we want you to know what's in it. The early 1980s metro station at Národní třída is the scene of a fascinating archaeological dig that we visit in this edition of Science Journal. This is Národní třída. The Národní třída that most of us know was a metaphorical hole even before the dig, a line of fast food kiosks between two chrome and plastic socialist structures that was a favorite stomping ground for beggars and winos. Plans to develop the plaza for office and shopping space has peeled back the grimy surface of this historic part of Prague and revealed century after century of history in strata that can be read like a book back to the 1100s. Here to do that for me is Polish archaeologist Tomasz Cymbalak, who is heading the dig here.
What we see in front of us are the remains of the townhouses that used to be here. There are five of them here, and the way they looked changed from small houses of townspeople to larger buildings that were built further back from the street. Through time, the structure gets more dense. They added wells and waste pits. And those are the places where we make the most finds. And aside from those coins, pottery fragments, bones and so on, we have taken various samples for archaeobotanic analyses, so we will be able to reconstruct the early Pragers' diet, the illnesses they suffered from, and so on.
So, from where we're standing now, about 4 or 5 meters above the bottom of the dig, we can see a very tight kind of maze of stone walls. You can see how busy the city was that long ago.
Yes, it shows the very lively development of this part of the city. The place where we are standing is actually the border between Old Town and New Town. Right next to the place we are studying was an ancient road that led from Prague Castle through Old Town to Vyšehrad. And one of the gates to the city through the fortification was a few dozen meters from here. So this was a gathering point for traders and other service tradesmen. In the later periods, like in the 17th and 18th century, then of course the social structure of the inhabitants changed and Renaissance buildings were built, followed by Baroque and Neoclassical and so on.
Archaeologists did of course know there would be findings here. Aside from the evidence from the sonar scans that preceded the dig, you will always find layers of pottery, bones and other relics wherever you dig down into city center Prague. But they were nonetheless greatly surprised by the excellent way everything under Národní třída had been preserved, even despite the encroachment of the metro in the 1980s and the dates that the evidence went back to. While they expected 14th century remnants from the establishment of New Town by Charles IV, they found even the predecessors of those structures, not the wooden and mud buildings themselves per se, but the outlines of them left like photo negatives in the ground. Another surprise was a burial site lying just under what is now Tesco.
What you see here is part of a burial site where the individual bodies have been laid in ordered rows, like on a chessboard. We have already dug out the graves here. The bodies were laying with their heads to the west, feet to the east, with their arms by their sides. And the state they were in was surprising, because they were wonderfully preserved. So all in all, we uncovered 6 graves that I would tentatively date to the turn of the 13th century.
So what do you know about the people who were buried here?
Víme, že mezi těma zemřelýma máme tak kolem.
We know that among them were about three women. The anthropological survey is still underway. The bones show that the deceased worked in a hunched-over position. They did hard work that left its mark on their skeletons. We're also going to do a DNA analysis as well, and from that we should have some approximate idea as to their ethnicity or where they were from.
Takže budeme snad možná vědět něco víc o přibližním etníku nebo místu, ze kterého pocházejí.
Can you describe what it probably looked like right here at Národní třída at the time in the 12th or 13th century when these graves were dug?
To osídlení muselo být o mnohem méně.
The structures were primarily wooden with a couple of stone buildings and were compacted together. The road network was much smaller than it is today. There were less streets, but the road that we are on just now existed even in the early Middle Ages, and that's Spalina Street. The water situation was different. There must have been several creeks here, and we know that the terrain was much more rolling, with small hills and sunken farm paths. There was, of course, much more greenery, bushes and trees. There were groups of houses, like countryside cottages, one next to the other, making small units. What was in this area was a small settlement that provided material support for the old town.
Under what is going to be a very modern multifunctional building at this site, you can follow the complex meshing of one era into another. As the farmers ran out of space for storing their products and feeding their animals, the space became used more and more by merchants and craftsmen, until even more people began moving into the city in the 19th century, and there is more residential rather than economic area. In the 20th century, the lot changes altogether, filling up with restaurants, offices, administrative spaces, and so on, showing the various needs of each century until it is cemented over for the construction of the Soviet-style metro station. The metro, in fact, runs just meters away from the ancient cellars still being explored and learned from beneath Spalina Street. Ah, now we're a good how many meters? Under the street?
4 or 5.
4 or 5 meters under the street. It's very cool now here, and it's very beautiful.
This is the oldest of the cellars that we have here, so it's from the mid-1300s. The layout of this cellar is beautifully legible, and it's a wonderful teaching aid for students and art historians. You can follow the development of building methods and urban transformation on the structure here. The walls show right here that the original floor was almost 2 meters higher, and the ceiling was not vaulted, but flat. As they ran out of space, they made these other cellars under the street. This one is twice as large, and they stopped changing things for the most part at the beginning of the 16th century. And next door, there are another 2 cellars, each about 3 times larger than this one.
Od toho začátku 16. století stejná. A tam jsou další 2 místnosti sklepní. Ty jsou, tak řekněme, ještě 3x větší než to, co jsme tady. Na co se díváme?
What we see here is a wartime passage hole. During World War II, when they found there were too few air raid shelters, the Protectorate government ordered that the Gothic cellars be used, because they were of such massive design. And they made passageways between them, so that if one began to collapse, people could run to another. It's wonderful, you have a real example here of how people lived and how things worked.
Je to paráda, protože tady máte vlastně ukázku toho, jak to žilo, jak to fungovalo.
That edition of Science Journal was first broadcast in August of 2010. Now, as ever of a Saturday, it's time for another trip down memory lane, or rather through the halls of the Czech Radio archives. Here's David Vaughan.
The early 1960s saw dramatic developments in the Cold War, with the building of the Berlin Wall and then the brinkmanship of the Cuban Missile Crisis. But there were also signs of a greater pragmatism in East-West relations. One channel for dialogue was a series of international gatherings where scholars and public figures discussed how to reduce the risk of armed conflict. These were known as the Pugwash Conferences, named after the town in Canada where the idea was first launched back in 1957. In September 1964, one such conference was held in the Czech spa town of Karlovy Vary. The participants included Henry Kissinger, at 41, already well known as an academic and advisor to the State and Defense Departments. He told Czechoslovak Radio what he saw as the priorities for reducing East-West tensions.
As far as the West is concerned, I think it is important that the existing frontiers of Germany be accepted. That is, that the frontiers with Czechoslovakia and Poland as they now exist be considered as the permanent boundaries of Germany, which means that the Munich Treaty should be formally abrogated insofar as any country still maintains that it has validity. In addition, I think the West should give Eastern European countries any assurances against legitimate security concerns that they have. As for the East, I believe it must accept two things. One, that the freedom of Berlin is not negotiable, and that Western troops will stay in Berlin, that they will not be withdrawn. Secondly, that the division of Germany is one of the obstacles towards a relaxation of tensions, and that if one wanted to make progress towards an all-European security system, one has to keep in mind that the division of Germany is unnatural and will only increase the tensions over an indefinite period.
Kissinger was interviewed by a bright young Czech reporter. His name was Jiří Dienstbier, and at the time, neither of them could have had an inkling that one day their lives would follow a similar path. In the 1970s, Henry Kissinger served in two U.S. administrations as Secretary of State. Just over a decade later, Jiří Dienstbier was to become Czechoslovakia's first post-communist foreign minister, having spent many years as a dissident after the Soviet-led invasion of his country in 1968. But for now, let's go back to 1964, and to Dienstbier asking Kissinger about a view expressed in his book, The Necessity for Choice.
You wrote that absolute security for one country means insecurity for all others. In this slide, how do you see the future possibility of nuclear disarmament?
In a society of states of about equal strength, if one country wants to be absolutely secure, it can do so only by neutralizing all others. That is the only way you can be sure, absolutely sure. Therefore, I think every country has to accept a measure of relative security. Now, relative security means that you have to run some risks. And this seems to me perfectly consistent with nuclear disarmament. You have to balance the risks of disarmament against the risks of continued armament. And I think most of us would feel that a measure of disarmament is more desirable than an indefinite continuation of the arms race.
That was David Vaughan with From the Archives, wrapping up Radio Prague's English program for today. If you'd like to listen again or recommend the program to others, we are always on the internet for you. Simply turn to our website at radio.cz. We're always happy to discuss your questions and comments. You can write to us by email at english@radio.cz, on Facebook or Twitter under Radio Prague, or of course with a good old-fashioned letter to Vinohradská 12, 12099, Prague. For me, Christian Falvey, thanks for listening and nasledanou. Thank you.
vous écoutez Radio Prague.